from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Royteam.
Good morning. Appreciate all of you for helping out and hanging out all the time with the G and Ursula Show. Right now, we got to get right to it. Travis Mayfield is in for Ursula. Travis, thank you so much for being here, sir.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun this morning.
Absolutely. Hey, coming up at 10:33. Rick Riz will join the show. The Rick Riz Show, we do that every Monday, at 10:30. He will jump on with us, and we'll talk about the Mariners. But right now, over the weekend, I read an article that was in the Seattle Times. It took me probably an hour to read it because I had to stop and start and stop and start. At the very end of this article, it was amazing. It talked about how between January of 2017 and November of 2020, there were 829 complaints, internal and external, that were lodged against Tacoma police employees, most for unsatisfactory performance or discourtesy. Of those, Travis, 84% were dismissed. Well, as of January, the Tacoma Police Department has a new police chief, and as of this weekend, Chief Avery Moore has a new issue to address with the public: how his department has handled internal complaints of racism. So joining us right now is Patrick Malone, staff reporter for the Seattle Times, and you can check out his latest article online, Black Police Blue Line: What Happened When a Tacoma Officer Challenged Institutional Racism. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you, G and Travis. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. Well, let's get right to it. Let's start at square one. Why did you start looking into how Tacoma Police Department handles officer complaints of racism?
Well, I was lucky enough that Valencia Brooks, who was sort of the person at the center of this story, came to me soon after her retirement last year. And she had collected over the years records from all these complaints that she had filed, many of them dealing with racism, but also about, just the contemporary issues that police officers face on the job, colleagues not wearing masks as expected, you name it. So Valencia was someone who took it upon herself to hold the department accountable for the things that it publicly said. This is a department that got millions of dollars in federal grants by promising zero tolerance for racism, including, what people would consider joking, offensive language, which is one of the examples we had in here. But what we saw when these reached the EEO office and then ultimately the chief of police during much of this time, Donald Ramsdale, was that they did not uphold those standards when it came to the complaints of their black officers.
And also in reading through this, Patrick, I read through a spokesperson, the city of Tacoma's human resources director, Shelby Fritz, declined an interview request and refused to answer questions about the quality of the investigations into Brooks' complaints, citing the city's privacy policy. Interesting privacy policy in the attempt to be transparent. Your thoughts on the amount of folks inside of the city government and police department that wanted to answer questions about this particular article, sir?
Well, it's a tough one because we want to get everything right. And the truth is, some of these complaints are in a black box. If it hadn't been for Valencia Brooks, coming forward and bravely sharing what she had collected very meticulously, the records of these complaints and how the department responded to them, we really wouldn't have been able to get this window into how they reconcile internal complaints. And I think really what made it powerful was the time frame that it covered and the numbers. So, every one of these incidents unto themselves are their own thing. And depending on people's perceptions, they could be highly aggrieved by them, moderately aggrieved by them, or not at all, based on some of the emails that I got. But the story that it tells collectively, if you think of each of these complaints as kind of a dot on a piece of paper, it starts to sort of form a very clear picture here that over time, These complaints were routinely dismissed, even when there was ample evidence of violation of policies. So I think one of the interesting questions going forward is going to be how Tacoma police respond to this in terms of their policies and practices. They certainly have data in their hands, such as how many complaints were filed by black officers, how many complaints were filed against black officers, how many black officers made it through the probationary period and were able to stay on. These are things that Tacoma was not able to answer, even though it's got the data in hand. And perhaps if it wants to take a more serious look at itself, it can start there.
Let's ask specifically, or let's talk specifically, can you give us some examples of some of the complaints that Officer Brooks actually made here? Because I read through them and my jaw was on the ground and I couldn't believe that they were not, you know, founded, basically, or that was not the conclusion.
Right. I think one that was particularly shocking was, you know, an insensitive term that was used by a sergeant at a call out meeting, which is, you know, the shift change meeting where, you know, the professional standards of the Tacoma Police Department require everyone to pay such close attention that it recommends taking notes. So, you know, when Valencia Brooks heard this offensive term, she reported it, and everyone who was believed to have been there was questioned by the EEO officer, and out of 19 who responded, only 3 acknowledged hearing the term. And that was a little bit troubling because it suggested either a casual regard for this term or, you know, perhaps worse when you have 16 out of 19 people saying they didn't hear it. So that one really stuck with me in terms of what it means culturally and what it says about the Tacoma Police Department. Others were, you know, a hate crime that was directed at a Muslim child, a middle school girl, that Brooks said wasn't taken as seriously as it should have been and that policies weren't followed. There was one instance of a former officer at Tacoma PD that while he was there mentioned to Brooks and 2 others in a very short span of time that he formerly associated with skinheads, white supremacists, and they all perceived that to be intimidation. But once again, that one was dismissed. And we could go on down the list, and each of these was dismissed, with the exception of one that was held up in a very narrow sliver portion of it that involved training about racial stereotypes. And Brooks said, hey, look, the way that this was presented only served to reinforce those. And that one was held up in a very narrow fashion, but much of it was upheld as well as legitimate training materials, despite some very offensive characterizations.
One of the things that really stood out to me was this part of it. Fred Scruggs, who recently retired as an assistant police chief, nearly all of her complaints against fellow officers were evaluated by then Captain Fred Scruggs, who at the time was head of TPD's Equal Employment Opportunity Office, where complaints of harassment and discrimination are routed. He was one of the few longtime black members of the department to climb its ranks. I think, Patrick, what really stands out to me in this story is Captain Fred Scruggs at the time is a black man that is overseeing this. And for some reason, all of the complaints by Brooks does not seem to raise the eye of him. And it seems like, according to what you wrote, that all of the complaints would stop and die with him.
It was very interesting, and I have to commend Mr. Scruggs for taking the time to talk with me. Not everybody I reached out to, was that brave, but he did. And he even talked about his own experience as a black man inside Tacoma Police Department, and I found that to be very enlightening. You know, he said racism does exist. It is not a fabricated or made-up thing. Yet, by the same token, you know, Valencia Brooks was highly frustrated with Mr. Scruggs because he was where her complaints seemed to go to die. And, he said, I did my job. I did my duty. I reviewed every one of these, made sure they didn't go away. But one of the reasons it's important that Val Brooks shared this information, including, you know, how the department responded to her complaints, is that we get to see why they dismissed them. And in 0 of these, not one of them was found to be unfounded, which would have been untrue, right? More often, and in virtually every case, the answer was does not rise to the level of a policy violation. And so we get into some really subjective ground right there. And, you know, Scruggs was not doing this alone. He was doing it in concert. He was evaluating these complaints along with city legal counsel, along with the city EEO officer. And so, you know, to say that this is anything less than an institutional response, I think would be selling it short.
That was incredible. I'm just, can you please repeat that? So none of her complaints were unfounded. They were all founded. They just simply didn't violate TPD policy?
Correct. Even some very explicitly written policy that I think any of us as rational human beings, you know, could read, that offensive language and terms that make groups feel marginalized, there's zero tolerance for it, even in joking. Well, we see a case of offensive language, and it was explained away by the sergeant as, hey, I don't remember if I said it, but if I did, I was probably joking, yet it doesn't rise to the level. And I think that it's that subjectivity that requires a much closer scrub of, you know, the way that these complaints were adjudicated. Sure, we get a passing glance from a really important study a year ago that says, you know, 84-85% of these complaints vanish into thin air once they're out there, but we don't know how many are determined to be unfounded, how many, you know, fall into this gray area of, you know, just missed the corner of the plate kind of subjectivity.
So zero of these were not found to be unfounded. And then, by the way, if you're just joining us, we have Patrick Malone, staff reporter for the Seattle Times, joining the G and Ursula show on his latest article. You can see that online. It's called Black Police Blue Line: What Happened When a Tacoma Officer Challenged Institutional Racism. And going back to, you did have discussions more with then Captain Fred Scruggs on this. And is there, if he had to do it over again, would he do things differently? If he's admitting to you that there's racism, and he's admitting to you that he went over all of these things, but for some reason it didn't rise to the level, is there any, like, if would he do things different, Patrick?
Well, he did not go that far, certainly. He did not say, I would have changed my mind about these. And in fact, he said he gave every one of her complaints a fair look. So, you know, I did not sense regret from him, and he certainly didn't say, I should have ruled differently. He stood by those decisions. But in the broader scale of things, he admitted, yeah, there is racism here. And quite frankly, you know, Valencia Brooks is not the only former black officer from Tacoma we've heard from, and there probably will be more to come on this. So, you know, I don't think we're done talking about it, but there are apparently other issues of racism, and Mr. Scruggs acknowledged those. He talked about what a challenging circumstance it is to be black and a police officer, that you're often caught in conflicting worlds, and he framed it as, you know, you have to find a way to survive. And he acknowledges and even praised Valencia Brooks for being that outspoken voice. He also acknowledged he was not that outspoken voice, that his way of navigating and surviving in a very difficult environment was to be diplomatic. That was the term he used. And so, you know, I think people can look at the judgments that he made in that role and what he said about being diplomatic and kind of draw their own conclusions.
I'm not being diplomatic when I say that Fred Scruggs was part of the problem and one of the biggest reasons as to why it is so hard and why it takes so much courage for people of color to even go to HR, to go and bring these up. As a matter of fact, the majority of the time, 90% of the time, we try to let it go and sleep on it and not say anything. And as someone who very truly understands that, that's what happens. I want to also talk about your one at the very end of the article. I brought that up in the beginning of this interview, and in it, and between January of 2017 and November of 2020, there was 829 complaints, internal and external, that were lodged against Tacoma police employees, for most being for unsatisfactory performance or discourtesy. Of those, Patrick, 84% were dismissed.
Yes, and the consultants who independently conducted this is a city commissioned report about, you know, what reforms are needed at Tacoma PD. And frankly, you know, that thing should have been in big neon letters when it was released inside the city of Tacoma, because it really did have some eye-popping, startling things. And what it showed us was that compared to other departments, Tacoma does not do a very good job, in fact, does a pretty poor job of evaluating complaints against its own officers. And so I think that, you know, the powers that be in the city of Tacoma would want to know and be a lot more curious about how they got there, what the problem is, and how they can fix it. And that would be really one stat to start with. They have all these EEO complaints and internal affairs complaints. You know, nobody has access to them the way that the police department and the city do. And it's going to be incumbent on them to analyze why it stands that way and where things are falling through the cracks.
TPD seems to have a diversity recruitment problem. Here you have this black female officer who is being incredibly brave, honestly, year after year after year, and yet they're not listening to her. It would seem to me, to fix your diversity recruiting problem, you should listen to the officer that you already have that you would like to recruit more of. So what are they going to do about this? Or do we just continue limping along with this same systemic problem?
Well, I think, you know, this may sound crazy, but I am 100% convinced that the Tacoma Police Department and the city of Tacoma sincerely desire to be more diverse than it is. And but how do you get there, right? And a lot of the officers I spoke with, current, you know, former black officers and Mr. Scruggs, have been heavily involved in this effort to try to recruit more black officers and more officers of color in general. But what do you think happens when one of them approaches a Valencia Brooks and asks, how was your experience here? You know, it's very different. And it's a little ironic as well that one of her complaints was actually for the fact that frequently, as soon as black officers were hired, they were shoveled in front of a camera and, you know, put in promotional materials to try to recruit more diverse candidates. And it's really a very difficult cycle to solve, because, you know, you want to be able to recruit from these communities. You have to be able to show that someone who looks like you, someone who shares your experience, works here. However, if those people's complaints are being continually rejected, if they're, you know, the times that they question the department living up to its own standards aren't taken seriously, you know, I think that that is a part of the equation that hasn't been addressed.
Patrick Malone, staff reporter for the Seattle Times, thank you for coming on with us. I love your work. Appreciate you, Patrick.
Thank you. I really appreciate both of you. It's great to meet you, Travis, and always good to talk with you, G.
All right. Coming up next, the Rick Riz Show, and the very own Rick Riz will join the show to talk about these Mariners and what we can expect out of them the next couple weeks. It's Gene Ursula with Travis.
And the right-hander's 1-2 pitch, the G-Man Choi, and a swing and a miss for strike three, and he did it. George Kirby walks off the diamond, striking out the side here in the top of the first inning in his first big league inning to a standing ovation.
The Rick Riz Show with G and Ursula.
Holy smokes.
Oh, it's Monday, 10:30. No one better than Rick Riz.
Hey, play my song.
Yeah.
That's the one by Dean Martin.
Let's get to it. So, Rick, the Mariners snapped their six-game losing streak on Sunday yesterday behind a strong start from top rookie prospect and a walk-off hit in the 10th inning from Ty France. Let's start with George Kirby. For fans who don't know that name, what kind of pitcher is this young man?
Well, I tell you what, first of all, tremendous ability, tremendous composure to be able to do that in his major league debut. And it was such a great story. His mom in the stands on Mother's Day to be able to come away with the best performance of any pitcher in Mariners history for their major league debut, six scoreless innings against that team, The Tampa Bay Rays, with 18 wins, the most wins in the American League this year, and he shuts out those guys and he strikes out the side in the top of the first inning. What kind of guy is he? Tremendous ability. He's a power pitcher with control, and that's so hard to do when you're a young pitcher, but he very, very seldom walks anybody. You know, down at AA Arkansas, he was 2-0 with a 1.82 ERA, 5 starts, 24 and 2/3 innings, guys. He walked only 5, and he struck out 32. So he doesn't beat himself. He fills up the strike zone with quality strikes, doesn't walk anybody. Lots of swings and misses with a fastball that just darts. He threw a fastball to Randy Arozarena where he just kind of chopped at it and swung and missed for strike 3 and made a really good hitter take a really funny swing because that ball moved so much, and then he had the great slider. He added the curveball and the changeup, and my goodness, there is just right now no ceiling for this kid after, you know, what he did yesterday before 30,000 fans, before his mom and dad, his two sisters, aunts and uncles, a lot of teammates from high school and his college days at Elon University. And I tell you what, he was amazing yesterday in his major league debut.
I got to tell you, Rick, I'm over here just bubbling. I was thinking what you were thinking. No, oh, no pressure. He gets up there. And the first couple of pitchers, I was a little worried. I was a little concerned. But, oh, my gosh, cool as a cucumber. And then his family, yeah. You know, they had all these people grabbed tickets and flew all the way to, because isn't he from, like, Long Island or he's from?
Rye, New York.
Rye, New York. He's from the boonies. But it was so exciting. It was such a fun game. Thanks for letting me interject,
really?
Guys. It was so good. It was so good.
What is that like for you, Rick? Like to be able to like broadcast a big day for like that, you know, this family for him. Like, what is that like for you when you get to kind of be a part of that?
Yeah, Travis, it was amazing. I said even on the air, I'm nervous for the kid. I'm like a proud papa. I mean, his dad was down there, so you know, I can only imagine what was going through his mind. I'm nervous for these kids, you know. Matt Brash was outstanding in his major league debut in Chicago on a cold day. It was their home opener in a big crowd. He was outstanding, then struggled, and he's down at Tacoma right now. He's going to be back, and now you got George Kirby to come up and to be able to do that. You want these kids to do so well. They're like your kids. I've been around baseball for 48 years, and you feel like, you know, you're a part of them, even though you don't know them real well yet. I had a chance to talk to him at spring training. He's a real quiet kid, but you root like crazy for him because you don't want to see him fail. You want to see him get off to a good start. So now he got off to a great start, and now I can't wait to see his next start, you know, when we get on the road. But I was so happy for him, and I couldn't be even more proud and, you know, than his dad. I could only imagine how many buttons he popped on his shirt and his mother on Mother's Day. You know, it's just so much fun to watch. I love these kids, and that's the future of your team. We got Logan Gilbert. He's only 24 years old. He came up, you know, last year and did great. And now he's one of the best pitchers in the American League. Here's George Kirby. We saw Matt Brash. There's more on the way. So there is such a great hope, you know, for the future of this franchise. And you got the veteran guys in that rotation. Robbie Ray is going to be outstanding. And Marco Gonzalez and Chris Flexen. Yeah, those guys, and I tell you what, it's just a big old ray of hope on Mother's Day. It was great.
Rick, you've been part of baseball for 48 years. I heard that when you said it. I just wanted to repeat that. And the Mariners, the Mariners yesterday, they snapped a 6-game losing streak. The reason why I'm bringing that up is because I've come to know that sometimes some fans maybe had their rally caps on yesterday. And in baseball, there's a lot of superstitions out there that work. I'm not asking you if you have any, because I know I have some, but what is some of the wildest superstitions or baseball rituals that you've seen in 48 years?
Well, I think the one that stands out, Wade Boggs, you know, had a great career, a Hall of Fame career, and he had to eat chicken before every game. I enjoy chicken, but I'm not going to eat it every day like he did. But in his mind, if he had some chicken, no matter what kind it was, you know, he was going to go out there and have a good game. Now, he had a good game because he was a great hitter. But if he thought it was the chicken that did it, great. And then there's always the superstition about even underwear or socks. You don't wash your socks or whatever, the way that you get into the batter's box, the path you take out to your position, or not stepping on a line or stepping on first base on the way to second base or shortstop or you know, everybody's got a little superstition, and if in their mind that's the reason why they had success the day before and maybe have it again that day, then they're going to keep on doing it. Trust me.
All right, Rick, I got to ask you like a personal question because I loved your answer to yesterday. So yesterday was obviously a high day, but you can't have a high day every single day. You've been doing this for 48 years. So what do you do on days where you're like, you know what, today I don't feel it. And yet I turn on the radio and you still sell it. So how do you do that?
Well, first of all, number one, I love it. I grew up, you know, on the south side of Chicago playing baseball ever since I could walk, you know, 4 years old, 5 years old in the sandlot behind my house. If you ever saw the movie Sandlot, that's the story of my life. You know, even with the dog, we had Mo the Sherman Shepherd in the movie. It was Hercules, the big old dog, but he was a cream puff at the end of the movie. I just grew up with a game of baseball. I got the love of the game from my mother, who was watching the Cubs every day I came home from school. Then later on, I would write Jack Brickhouse a letter when I was 12, and he wrote me back a letter. I'm going to be a major league broadcaster. My dad would come home. My dad loved baseball. He would take my brother and I out to Comiskey Park at night. So I had the Cubs during the day, the White Sox at night. And I just loved the game. And I realized that there's the baseball season is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And you can't get down if you lose a ball game or if you lose six or if you lose 10. The Mariners did that in May of last year. They had a terrible first half of the month of May, but they bounced back. They're in baseball, there's always hope, and there's always tomorrow. You know, whereas in football, if you lose six in a row, the season is over because you only play 16 ball games. But in baseball, we play 162 of these things, and there's always tomorrow in the game of baseball, and there's always time to make up a slow start. Now, if you have this in September and August, it's tough because I recall 1995, we were 13 games out of first place on August the 1st, and we still had time. It's amazing they did what they did in August and September. They made up those games. They tied the Angels, had the one-game playoff, made it to the playoffs for the first time. So baseball is the greatest game in the world where there's still hope, and it kind of reflects life. You know, even though you're having a bad day or a bad month, there's always, you know, with your ability to bounce back and believe in yourself and have faith that, you know, things are going to get better. And that's the way baseball is. It reflects life. And things are going to get better for this organization because of what I saw from that kid last night, Ty France with the walk-off base hit, to win it in the 10th, Abraham Toro to tie the game. There's always hope. You don't run out of time. You run out of outs in baseball. Toro hits that home run. Dylan Moore had a great game last night. A diving stop behind the bag to get an out at second. That saved a run. He had a bunt to lead to the winning run. So, I'm all excited. You got me all excited.
Hey, next week. Hey, Rick Riz.
There's always hope.
Next Monday. You and I, yeah. I want to talk about you being from the south side of Chicago because I am from the south side of Chicago.
Really?
I grew up baseball, the Jeffrey Manor, 100th and Merrill.
Okay, I was on the south side, 127th of Western in Blue Island and Calumet Park.
Absolutely.
In that area.
I played my baseball at Roseland. We can get all into it.
My dad is from Roseland.
See? That's what I'm saying. Baseball was my first love. Leon Durham, Ron Say, Larry Boa.
Gately's People Store. Oh, man.
Yeah.
My dad is from Roseland.
Absolutely.
He's from Roseland.
We'll do this next time. Thanks, Rick. Appreciate you, buddy.
Oh, we're out of time. Let's keep going.
We'll see you next Monday.
Thanks, Rick.
See you next Monday.
All right. Hey, coming up next on the Gene Ursula Show, Travis and I, I'm going to throw a curveball, and the curveball is this. We had our discussion with Patrick Malone on what's going on with the Tacoma Police Department and that discussion about diversity. Patrick Malone believes that the city of Tacoma and the police department does want diversity. The question is, how can they go about it? I'm going to ask Travis what he believes the problem is when it comes to adding diversity at companies. Gene Ursula with Travis. Few minutes, and yes, we usually do scenarios during this time, but I decided to change it up considering that you and I, we had a discussion with Patrick Malone here on our show. And the reason why we had Patrick Malone, who is a staff reporter of the Seattle Times, we had him on because of his latest article that's online right now. It's called Black Police, Blue Line: What Happened When a Tacoma Officer Challenged Institutional Racism. And I asked that, and I'm changing it up because I want to talk about diversity. And it was something that Patrick said.
Yeah.
And he said, I believe the city of Tacoma and the government and the police agencies, I believe that they want diversity. And then you and I off the air agree with Patrick. We, both you and I, agree that companies want diversity.
Yeah.
The problem is the how. Your thoughts on that topic?
I think that they don't know what they don't know. I mean, honestly, I think it's like they want a formula. Okay, I'm going to hire 25% more people of color. I'm going to hire 15% more LGBT. And then they are like, okay, we did it. Now we're done. And we, you know, we want to do check off the sensitivity training every year. Okay, everybody did it. You got it into HR. Okay, good. We're now a more diverse company. But that's just not what it is. Like, it is, there's not a formula. There's not a, it's a, like, you gotta live it, and every person in the organization has to live it every single day, and it's hard work. Hard work. And there's not a, today I'm gonna check these three boxes, and today we're not racist. That just doesn't exist.
You know how I know it's hard? This is how I know that this, it's hard and it can't be fixed with, oh, you just take this training class and it will show you the way. No. Because it's a continuation. But the reason why I really know it's hard is because I know what the three of us, meaning myself, Chef, and Ursula, and how over the last 2.5 years we do this show. So sure, people on the outside say, oh man, that show is this. But the truth that I have to tell you guys, and one day it'll be in a book and it'll be in a movie, I cannot tell you the real battles and uncomfortable conversations and discussions that the three of us have had amongst each other.
Yeah.
And we literally love each other.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But we've had real uncomfortable conversations. So now when I see corporate America send out these little handouts and this and that, and don't say this and don't say that, and oh, we're all one and we're under this blanket, and I'm like, you know what? You guys really don't want to make things right. Because usually there's somebody at the top that is sitting there with their view on how things should be.
Yeah, that, I mean, that, I asked it of Patrick Malone. I mean, it's exactly that. So TPD has a recruitment problem. They're not, they have a, you know, diversity recruitment problem. You have a woman of color who is dedicated, has grown up her whole life. She's wanted to be a cop. And she's telling you there are problems. A lot of them. She has documentation. She wants to work with you. And you're not listening to her. That's your problem. You're trying to tell other people from the top down, this is how we do diversity.
Yep.
Instead of actually listening to the people who live it and breathe it every single day and saying, let them tell us what the problems are, and let us together try to fix it.
It's really that simple. And I just don't know why corporations don't do it.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they just don't want to listen. Because if you listen, you could probably alleviate and cut in half your problems.
Right. Listen and believe. Believe your people when they tell you something.
Well, it's kind of a paradox, because until you get a critical mass of a certain number of people that represent a certain population in your organization, you can always take that one person who is vocal and you can cast them as a malcontent, as someone with a bone to pick, etc. But I don't care, you know, whether you're black, you're white, you're Republican, you're conservative. If you are the only person in your office that represents your viewpoint or your worldview, it's going to be extremely hard for you to speak out, and it's going to be extremely hard for you to find allies that back you up. And if people aren't listening to that one person, how are you ever going to get enough people there to actually be listened to? That is a very difficult challenge.
Well, I think the best way, what we, the Gene Ursula Show, can bring to this, no, we don't have the answers. We don't have the answers. No, we're not necessarily fixing anything. But the more we talk about this, the better that we all can be, and the better tomorrow that we all strive for. Hey, coming up next, in Agree to Disagree, who knows what my man Chef has cooked up? I haven't seen him in a while, so we'll see. But the question is this. Do you like the new Space Needle's new paint job? And does it remind you of what Seattle is best known for? We do that next. Gene Ursula with Travis.